Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your stack of research and try to turn complexity into clarity. You handed us a dense, really fascinating set of sources this time, all focused on one single thing, the herbicide glyphosate, which, you know, most people just know as Roundup.
And it's classic deep dive topic, isn't
That's
it? Because it forces you to look beyond just the chemistry. You have to look at the mechanics of scientific integrity itself. We're not just looking at data today. We're looking at how that data gets made.
Who paid for it, and maybe how long its influence really lasts.
Exactly.
So our mission today is to navigate two pretty major but connected threads from your sources. First up is the epidemiological side. The human health data. We're digging into a recent analysis that revisits an older, really high-profile study from back in 2005, the DeRoos study.
Right, which looked at cancer rates among pesticide applicators in the Agricultural Health Study, the AHS.
And the second thread is, well, it's about the dramatic ethical fallout. The huge news from just recently, the December 2025 retraction of a 25-year-old foundational safety paper.
The Williams, Crows, and Monroe Report. Pulled after years and years of scrutiny over ghostwriting allegations.
So you see the tension right there. On one side, you have these tentative findings from real human populations hinting at potential problems. And on the other, you have decades of regulatory policy that relied on safety data, some of which we now know is, well, ethically broken. Let's start with the human side of this.
Yeah.
So the AHS findings. The DeRoos paper from 2005, this was all about cancer rates among pesticide applicators who were exposed to glyphosate. If you just read the abstract, what was the big conclusion that regulators took away from it at first?
Well, the initial takeaway, and the one that got reported widely, was actually pretty reassuring. The researchers found no association between glyphosate exposure and cancer incidence.
Overall?
And for most of the specific cancer subtypes they looked at, again, no clear link. But, and they were very quick to point this out, their conclusions were tentative. They stressed it needed follow-up.
And that note of caution turned out to be really important, didn't it? Because there was one standout finding, one cancer subtype that did signal a potential issue.
Multiple myeloma,
right.
Or MM.
And this is where the statistical details get really interesting and messy.
Very messy. So when they looked at the entire group of applicators who said they used glyphosate, the age-adjusted relative risk for multiple myeloma was 1.1.
Which is basically no difference, right? A one-to-one risk.
Essentially, yeah. The risk was about the same as the general population. And you have to look at the confidence interval, the CI, which was wide, 0.5 to 2.4. So statistically, you can't confidently say there was any elevated risk in that big group.
But then they started slicing the data differently. They filtered it down to a smaller, more refined subgroup. Only the people they had complete data for on all the other factors. Age, diet, smoking, what they call covariates.
And that's when the number just exploded.
Yeah.
In that smaller, fully adjusted group, the relative risk jumped sharply all the way to 2.6.
Whoa, wait. So 2.6-inch in plain English? That means that group had more than double the risk of multiple myeloma. That seems like a massive red flag.
It sounds like it, but this is why we have to talk about that confidence interval again. In this case, it was still incredibly wide, 0.7 to 9.4.
And because that range still includes 1.0, which means no increased risk.
The finding is statistically shaky. It's often because the sample size is just too small. DeRoos and her team even noted that, look, even without the fancy adjustments, that smaller subgroup still showed about a twofold increased risk.
So how do scientists handle that kind of ambiguity? You have this small, high signal that might just be statistical noise. What do you do?
Well, you don't ignore it, but you absolutely do not overstate it. The authors were clear. This jump in risk could be due to selection bias, or something called effect modification.
Meaning the risk only shows up in very specific circumstances.
Exactly. Or in a very specific group of people. Their final conclusion, their scientific mandate, was simple. Be patient. The only way to really know was to wait for more cases of cancer to show up in the cohort over time and then rerun the numbers with a bigger sample.
And that is a huge takeaway for you, the learner. Epidemiology isn't instant. Sometimes the most scientific answer you can give is simply, we need more time and more data.
Okay, so moving on from that multiple myeloma finding. The DeRoos paper itself got criticism right when it came out, specifically about its review of the toxicity literature. And this gets to a really critical distinction in this whole debate.
It's the difference between the pure active ingredient and the formulated product you buy off the shelf. For decades, you know, regulators like the US EPA, the WHO, they've concluded that the active ingredient, pure glyphosate, isn't mutagenic. It doesn't damage DNA in a way that would cause cancer. But nobody is out there spraying pure crystalline glyphosate on their fields. They're using Roundup, which has all these other chemicals in it, surfactants, other additives, to make it stick to weeds and work better. It's a whole cocktail.
Precisely. And DeRoos and her colleagues cited studies, like work from Mark and others in the early 2000s, suggesting that these formulated products could have greater toxic effects than just the active ingredient by itself.
And the mechanism was subtle. It wasn't about directly mutating DNA.
No, it was about disrupting cell cycle control, basically messing with the cell's internal clock and safety checks.
Which, if you're messing with the cell cycle, that's immediately relevant to cancer. It suggests those extra ingredients aren't just inert carriers. They might be making the whole mix more toxic.
Exactly right. And the whole focus shifts from, is the main ingredient a carcinogen, to, is the whole commercial product biologically disrupted? It's a massive distinction.
Now, critics of the paper also brought up whether some of those studies, the ones showing toxic effects, met certain regulatory standards, specifically something called good laboratory practices, or GLP.
Right, and the DeRoos authors gave a great explanation of this that we should all remember. GLP is not a standard for scientific truth. It's a regulatory compliance tool. It's mainly used for contract labs that are providing routine data for, say, pesticide licensing.
So it's more about the paper trail. Auditing and legal accountability.
Think of it that way, yeah. GLP ensures the data is auditable. It's like having a detailed receipt for everything you did. But investigators doing fundamental research, they aren't usually required to follow GLP. Their quality assurance comes from a totally different place. Peer review and replication.
So one is about regulatory paperwork, and the other is about scientific rigor. Can other labs get the same result?
That is the key difference. The authors made the point perfectly. GLP is necessary for regulatory stuff, but a lack of GLP doesn't automatically mean the research is wrong. Not if it's published in a good journal, and most importantly, if other independent scientists can replicate it.
Okay, that whole discussion of regulatory standards is a perfect and kind of tragic pivot point. Because if scientists were already debating auditing rules for basic research, what does that say about the ethical breakdown we saw with what was arguably the biggest safety study ever published on this?
You're talking about the Williams, Crows, and Monroe paper from the year 2000. For years, this thing was bedrock. It was this huge review in a journal called Regulatory Toxicology and Pharmacology, RTP. And it basically concluded that both glyphosate and Roundup were safe for humans.
And its influence was just enormous. The EPA, other agencies around the world, they relied on it for decades to say glyphosate was safe.
Oh, absolutely. According to your sources, it exerted considerable influence, shaping public understanding, scientific discourse, and policy decisions. It was the source. And then in December of 2025, a full quarter of a century later, it was officially retracted.
And what's so wild here is who finally got the journal to act? It wasn't a rival scientist or an environmental group. It was two academics who were just studying corporate ghostwriting as a phenomenon. An astrophysicist named Alexander Karoff and Naomi Oreskes, the science historian.
It's such a powerful detail. It took outsiders, people looking at the process and not the toxicology, to finally push for it. Karoff even said they were shocked that after the Monsanto papers revealed the ghostwriting years earlier, no one had actually submitted a formal retraction request.
It just shows you how much inertia these big foundational papers have, how high the bar is to get rid of something that's become regulatory gospel. So let's get into the core ethical breakdown. What did the journal's editor-in-chief actually cite as the fatal flaw?
The fatal flaw was a complete lack of authorial independence and transparency. The editor listed several really serious concerns: misrepresentation of who contributed what, and just ambiguity. Ambiguity about how much the paper's conclusions, the very conclusions that said there was no cancer risk, were influenced by Monsanto. To put it simply, it looked like the company wrote the answers and the academic authors just put their names on the homework.
That ghostwriting, that lack of transparency, it's the ultimate sin in science. But we have to hear the other side. What did Bayer, who owns Roundup now, say to defend the paper?
Bayer has a very aggressive defense. They maintain that glyphosate is the most studied herbicide in history, with thousands of safety studies that have nothing to do with them.
And what about that specific retracted paper?
They claim that Monsanto's involvement was appropriately cited in the acknowledgments, which those acknowledgments thanked Monsanto scientists for significant contributions. They're essentially saying the link was disclosed, so regulators knew what they were looking at.
But if the text was actually written by the company, a thank you note in the back doesn't really seem like a full disclosure of authorship, does it?
And that is the heart of the ethical debate. Bayer also leaned heavily on the weight of global regulatory consensus. They pointed to the European Food Safety Authority, EFSA, which said in 2017 that its experts were under no illusion about the links when they do their own assessment. And crucially, Bayer points out that the Williams paper was only 2 out of about 700 references that EFSA looked at.
But that raises a big question, doesn't it? If those 2 ghostwritten papers were the foundational ones, the big reviews that summarized everything for a generation of regulators, doesn't that make them way more important than just 2 out of 700?
Foundational papers cast a very long shadow. They absolutely do. And Bayer's bottom line, despite all this, is that the overwhelming global consensus among regulators is still that glyphosate is not carcinogenic. Full stop. Regardless of what happened to that one paper from 2000.
So here we are. A paper that shaped policy for 2 decades is now officially ethically compromised. It's retracted. But in the digital age, does retracted really mean gone?
Unfortunately, no, not at all. This is what some people call the afterlife of scientific findings. A retraction is a formal process, but information on the internet is a different beast. A quick search still brings up an unretracted version of the Williams paper on the NIH website, and on a place like Wikipedia, citations to it have been declining, sure, but they haven't disappeared.
It's like trying to pull a fake news story off the internet. Even if the source takes it down, the echoes and the copies are just everywhere.
Exactly. And that digital shadow leads us to a much more modern problem: artificial intelligence.
Right. If AI models are being trained on these massive data sets scraped from the internet from places like Wikipedia, and that training data includes compromised studies,
then the AI inherits the bias. The AI becomes this black box that has absorbed the conclusions from literature that we now know is invalid, and we have no idea what the lag time is before those models are updated to ignore that bad information. The algorithms are literally learning from a flawed version of history.
That's a huge integrity problem for the future of research. But the sources did point to AI as a potential tool for good in this kind of work, too.
That's the other side of the coin, yeah. Kaurov, one of the investigators, specifically said AI was invaluable for their own work. The sheer volume of documents, policy reports, internal memos, papers, it's just too much for a human team to process. AI helped them connect the dots, and they hope it could lead to a renaissance in this kind of scientific investigation. AI might be the best tool we have to uncover the next ghostwritten paper.
So to bring this all to a close, we've really looked at 2 very different kinds of data around glyphosate. On the one hand, you've got this nuanced, uncertain human data from the AHS cohort. It flagged a small, statistically shaky concern for multiple myeloma and basically demanded more patients.
And on the other hand, you have the absolute ethical certainty of the ghostwriting scandal. A landmark safety paper, one that gave regulators assurance for decades, was proven to be compromised. No question about it.
And this tension just perfectly captures how hard it is to regulate these complex, high-stakes products. You're always dealing with scientific uncertainty and, at the same time, massive corporate pressure.
We also saw how the technical details are everything, the difference between the pure ingredient and the formulated product, and how regulatory standards like GLP are not the same thing as scientific rigor.
The biggest challenge we're left with, though, seems to be less about the chemical itself and more about our whole knowledge ecosystem. The fact that an officially retracted paper can still be out there, still influencing public opinion, maybe even training our future AI systems. It raises a huge question for you, the learner, to think about.
When a scientific source is proven to be compromised, how long does its shadow actually linger in our digital world? How quickly can good, reliable knowledge truly replace bad data? Is one retraction notice enough to clean the slate? Or is the ghost of bad science always going to haunt the machine? Something to think about as you process what you've learned today.